Well, today, for the first session in the afternoon, we're going to step outside of a little of the normal discussion regarding international arbitration. The reason we're going to step outside of it is we're going to invade one of the areas of orthodoxy about why arbitration is so much more preferable to litigation. And that reason, one of those reasons that's usually cited, is that arbitration is not subject to a proper appeal. Setting aside notwithstanding or a challenge to the final award, a proper review on the merits of the case is not possible in arbitration. At least that is the, as I said, the orthodox approach to why international arbitration is one of the reasons, I should say, not certainly the only reason, but one of the reasons often cited for why arbitration is preferred over litigation. But we have seen some challenge to this notion over the last decade, at least. Beginning in the late 1990s, the development of arbitral appeals processes, where the appeal process is part of the arbitration process, was developed. It's not exactly clear where the genesis for this idea lies, but we think, if I was to look at it, it might be somewhere with the CPR. Certainly JAMS was one of the original larger institutions to propose a arbitral appeal process, an internal arbitral appeal process. And it's been followed up as well by the AAA ICDR rules. And as we'll go through a little bit in the introductory part of this portion of this session today, it has also been adopted by other institutions, including those, a few, at least outside of the United States. Now, to round out this discussion today, we have three excellent contributors. We have to my immediate left, Mike Martinez. Now, I've met Mike, I think it was on a stage like this about 8 years ago, when we were both participating in one of these events, and we were co-panelists, and I've always appreciated Mike's insights. Mike has gone through all iterations, I think, of the Practicing Law as counsel, starting out as an AUSA, and then moving into private practice with Crown Morning in Washington, D.C. for quite a number of years. And then moving now to Marriott International, where he's leading part of the dispute resolution group with the internal legal department, which of course is a huge responsibility given the size of Marriott's operations throughout the world that only are getting bigger. Next to Mike is Tina Cicchetti. I think I said Cicchetti. Cicchetti, okay, sorry. Now Tina, I've gotten to know over the years because she is just an ever-present personality and person in the international arbitration community of Canada. Up there in Vancouver, she has had a long practice period with Bascom Martineau, where she was a counsel in numerous international arbitrations, has established herself very well in that area, and now has moved into the field of being full-time neutral arbitrator and established her own practice in that field. And I'm very happy to report that signs are that things are going extremely well in that area, and we're, of course, very pleased to see that. And next to Tina is Grant Kim, who is somebody I met, I think, about 5 years ago, probably, at another event similar to this one. And I've grown to appreciate Grant's insights as we've cooperated on various presentations and issues over the years. Grant was long history with premier legal practices, including Morrison Foerster, and recently joined another firm with offices in San Francisco and in Los Angeles called LibNexus, where he's also quickly growing as an arbitrator as opposed to counsel work. That transition is clearly underway for him as well, and it's coming very, I think, very easily given his reputation in this field. So we're very glad that we can have these three speakers to contribute on this topic today. So let's get into just an overview quickly of what we're talking about today. The international appeals process is compared to, let's say, a challenge that's brought to a final award before a court of proper jurisdiction. It is an appeals process that involves the actual review, depending on the standard review that's permitted, of some aspect of the merits of the case. Could be a legal question, could be even a factual question. And the process has been developed as an add-on to the normal arbitration procedure, which runs its course through until the final award. Now, this process is somewhat controversial because the fact that, as I mentioned at the outset, it is an issue that most of the time is not associated with international arbitration. It's associated with one of the reasons why you don't go to litigation and you choose international arbitration. But nonetheless, it is a consensual process, and people, or parties, are choosing it. We don't know how to have specific statistics on it, but there is, last time I checked in on this issue with JAMS, there is a substantial amount of case law in the area of appeals, and it's something that's certainly not uncommon in that area. In fact, in preparing for this presentation, I saw one of the first cases I've seen sent to us and provided by Tina, coming out of British, of course, British Columbia, or somewhere there.
Alberta.
Sorry, I forgot that part. Where we've actually seen the appeals process come under scrutiny by courts in relation to a final award that was modified by an appeals tribunal. So there is evidence that this process is being used, and in the case in particular from Alberta, in the ICDR context. Well, just quickly going through the different options, we don't want to spend a lot of time on the minutia of the appeals process that is written and set out in various rules. But just quickly going through some of the options, we have a JAMS of optional appeal procedures, one of the ones that are currently available. Now, it takes the position that the standard of review is something that is going to be the same as what is applied in the seat of the jurisdiction of, by the courts at the seat of the jurisdiction, the jurisdictional seat, rather. And so it does not give a specific standard of review. Tina will discuss that a little bit more as we're going through this. Additionally, it's also a consent-driven process. There's some interesting limitations on briefing and time limits that are involved, and it's intended by the way that the process is designed to be a fairly quick process. Yet, I can tell you from experience, it's not always the case. In fact, having been involved with one that went well beyond the original timelines, it might take a little bit longer. The AAA ICDR appeal process is similar in structure to what you find in JAMS, except for one of the definite differences. They have a specified grounds for appeal, whereas, as I said earlier, the JAMS standard review and grounds for appeal remain a bit more open. There's a fairly strict time frames, and the panels, in both JAMS and in the ICDR situations, the panels are not allowed to remand a decision back to the original arbitrator, which is kind of interesting because in the context of a normal appeal within the court system, we might expect to see the original decision come back to the original, the court of first jurisdiction with instructions to follow the appeal. And so this process does not happen, and in fact the appeals process oftentimes in both the ICDR and the JAMS situation call for the appellate tribunal or the second level tribunal to accept new evidence if they find there's basis to do so, which turns them into now a sort of trial, if you want to put it that way, sort of arbitration tribunal in the first instance, in the sense that they reopen the procedure and then start to take new evidence if there's grounds for doing that. Now, we wanted to go a little bit north, and we went up to the BCICAC, which is the British Columbia International, or the chamber up there, arbitration chamber. Now, Tina and I had some review of these rules, and we both agree that they are not the best crafted set of rules out there. They do leave some question as to when an appeal sort of is possible. But in general, we think that they generally follow the same procedure as you see the standards that are set forth in JAMS and AAA. The appeals tribunal has some discretion to determine the scope and the right of appeal, though, even if it's been agreed, apparently. We don't clearly see from the rule exactly how that works. So some drafting and some editing maybe has been called for up north. Now, here's one of the options that I found out there, because you don't see that this concept of appellate procedure within the international arbitration system really adopted too much outside the United States and Canada. However, we do see one example of that with the Spanish Court of Arbitration. The Spanish Court of Arbitration is not a widely used institution outside of Spain. Nonetheless, it does have a somewhat international caseload. Now, the approach to appeal in this instance is again, the grounds for appeal and the basis for appeal in the rules is really kind of hard to discern from the way it's drafted. And the only conclusion I can draw from that, and I've checked this with others and they seem to agree, is that the approach to the appellate level review in the Spanish Court of International Arbitration is, or Spanish Court of Arbitration, is that it really takes on the flavor of a civil law type appeal, which is to say a real second run of the entire procedure before another tribunal, a real review comprehensively of what's happened in the first instance. If that's the case, that makes sense why they don't refer to it as an appeal tribunal, but so much as a second instance arbitration process. And it really kind of is a broad process, although the time frames are quite tight. So one can surmise from those two points that while they have the freedom to look at a number of different things, there isn't a lot of time to be that comprehensive. Okay, so that kind of takes us through some of the initial idea, discussion of what's out there. That's a bit of the roadmap of the options that are currently in play in this field of arbitral appeals. Now with that, I'm going to hand over the clicker to Mike, and he's going to take us through from the general, especially for adding to it from the in-house counsel and general counsel perspective, is this appellate process really something that we ought to embrace? Is this an area that we ought to put our arms around and get comfortable with, or should we kick it to the curb and never do it again? So Mike's going to take us through his presentation on this.
All right, thank you, Nathan. I really appreciate you inviting me for this presentation. So when we were putting this panel together, Nathan threw up a question to all of us. What do you guys think of this idea of appeals among various arbitration groups? And I probably reacted the most strenuously and said, I think it's a terrible idea. And he goes, well, good, then you're going to talk about it being a terrible idea. So let me give you the reasons I think that's the case. So first of all, let's start with the question, why do we use arbitration? And Nathan's touched on this a little bit. We use it for a number of reasons, because it's an alternative to litigation. It's supposedly faster and less expensive, although I think that's not always the case, but it's often the case. There's generally no discovery like you have in a U.S. litigation context. It results in a final binding award with no appeal, although I would grant you that sometimes you can move to set aside the decision or challenge the decision in a local court, but as a general rule, you get an award and you can't appeal it. And confidentiality is often a factor. That's another reason why you might use arbitration. Additional reasons are enforcement of the award. You can now enforce the award under the New York Convention in approximately 150 countries. It limits the risk to exposure to a lawsuit in foreign courts that may be biased or inadequate. That's a good reason, for example, with Marriott, why we would enter into a contract over a hotel in a foreign country, because we want to get it resolved through arbitration rather than be subject to whatever a local court might do. It unifies the company's approach to certain kinds of disputes, and the arbitrators are potentially, in fact, usually, more often, more sophisticated than judges you might get. So there are a number of reasons why we would use arbitration. Reasons why we might not use arbitration are it's often not very efficient or quick. Now, this kind of contradicts what I just said about you want to do it because it's quicker and faster, and I think that's traditionally the way arbitration has been, although over time it's become less so, and I think adding a provision that says you can appeal it further undermines why you would use arbitration, because that just makes it go longer, makes it more expensive. American-style discovery is starting to creep into proceedings. We had a little bit of discussion about that earlier today. And you have limited ability to publicize results and lack of precedential value. Again, this is contrary to the earlier point about having confidentiality and choosing arbitration. Sometimes you might not want confidentiality. You might want a decision that you can rely upon in later proceedings as a precedent. So that would be a downside of using arbitration. So, adding all this up, do we want an appellate process? And my view is no, we do not. As I said, there are already mechanisms to try and set aside an arbitration award, and also in certain circumstances you can pursue court challenges to challenge an award. Let me just give you a couple of examples. I come at this from my experience both before I joined Marriott 7 years ago and since I've been with Marriott. We have a case before the ICC in Paris involving a management agreement that we terminated over the operation of the Marriott in Beirut, Lebanon. And we did that probably about 12 years ago. The arbitration commenced in 2010. We prevailed in 2011 on, it was kind of a technicality, but it was basically what the arbitration panel held was that the plaintiff in the case did not have the authority to pursue the arbitration. And the reason for that is because in the process of the arbitration getting set up, the company sold, and this new guy who was purporting to act on behalf of the company didn't have the authority to do so. So we ultimately prevailed because the panel decided they didn't have the authority. So he then, after losing the arbitration, filed an appeal of that in the Court of Appeal in Paris. The three-judge panel reversed and held in his favor, which was somewhat unprecedented, as I understood it. And we convened a local counsel in Paris. They advised us that this was a good case to try and take to the French Supreme Court. So we did. We took it to the French Supreme Court, where we prevailed. It got remanded back to a different Court of Appeals, the Court of Appeals in Versailles, where we also prevailed, but at this point the other side raised some new evidentiary issues saying that we had procured the original result through fraud. The Court of Appeals in Versailles decided not to hear that, but ruled in favor of Marriott. The other side then appealed that decision back to the French Supreme Court. They ruled in favor of Marriott. And so now we're back to, we just got this favorable decision in January. And now we're back to the panel, or back to the ICC. The other side first moved the ICC to reopen and remand the whole thing back to the original panel, which we opposed. Then he withdrew that, and I'm told is now thinking about filing a brand new lawsuit in the local courts of Versailles. So this is, in my mind, a wonderful example of how where arbitration sort of goes off the rails. It obviously, in this context, it was not because of ICC rules or because of anything else. It was, frankly, it's because of this particular plaintiff, who once told me about 3 years ago that I'm going to be litigating against Marriott in 10 years. We're going to be back in this room 10 years from now. And I'm like, knock yourself out. Anyway, so that's an example, I think, of why, I think an appellate process layered into all of that, that's part of the ICC rules, is just a bad idea. Part of the reason you go into arbitration is because you want a decision, you want to get it resolved, and then you move on. And if you think you've got some really, you're very vulnerable, then don't go to arbitration, settle the case. You go into all these things thinking that way. To sum up some of the reasons why I think right to appeal is a bad idea, it adds to the cost, it adds to the length of the proceedings, it serves to undermine the very reasons for having arbitration in the first place, offers opportunities for mischievous parties to avoid a day of reckoning, and although finality in arbitration without appeal is risk, because obviously sometimes you lose and you think you did a fair shake, that's the gamble you take. I mean, that's why you litigate too. You if you lose, you might say you didn't get a fair shake, and you've got that appellate process there, and if that's what you want to do, go litigate. But if you're going to arbitrate, I just don't think that having an appellate process built into that entire arbitration panorama of rules and things is a good idea. So you're welcome to disagree with me. I'm glad to hear any comments you have, but we can maybe do it after everybody's spoken. But that's why I think that an appellate process as part of an arbitration process is not a good idea.
Well, let's go ahead and pick up on that for a few minutes before we move on to the next presentation, and certainly open up for a few questions from the audience at this time as well. But let me just begin by, I will go ahead and take the position, not that I feel it, or not that I'm, this is necessarily from the heart, but I will go ahead and take the position, at least probe this a little bit, that maybe this is a good idea, and I will defend all of the aspiring appellate arbitrators out there that your hopes may not be dashed, because there may be some reason to do this. You just described this process that you went through. Now, that was a process that didn't have an arbitral appeal process.
Right.
And so what you see is that the arbitration process is still potentially fraught with lots of delay.
Sure.
And lots of review that can take place, even though the review is supposed to be extremely limited. Wouldn't it be better if, as opposed to going through the process that you just went through in Versailles and Paris, if you had an appellate review that had reviewed the issues in the award, had provided a very reasoned explanation to why one party was either right or wrong as objections about the final award, and settled the matter right then and there, such that a further court that looks at this question is now presented with a record in which everyone's had full opportunity to criticize this issue, criticize the final award, and have it resolved. I mean, wouldn't that have sort of cut off the process that you're going through?
I don't think so, because what would have stopped, he could have gone back to the original panel. In fact, he did go back to the original panel and say, you got this wrong, here's why. And they said, too bad, you know, this is the way we ruled, and he took it off to the various French courts that I described. And I think that more likely than not, in a circumstance, if you had that appellate process available with the ICC, he would have utilized that process. Perhaps still lost, maybe not. Perhaps still lost, and then would have gone off to the French courts as he did anyway. It would have been one more step in a long process.
Tina, in Canada, has there been a growing outcry for more appeals, or is this something that's absurd north of the border, as it is in the Washington D.C. area?
Yeah. I made a couple of notes coming out of the panels this morning that sort of linked, in my mind at least, what I thought we were going to talk about this afternoon with what I heard this morning. And if I can answer your question indirectly that way. So I made a few notes. So Abe Sofer said, there may be an issue with due process because there's an absence of merit-based review of arbitration awards. So you need to keep that in mind within the process. Jack said, you really want to get it right. Really important to get it right because there is no review on merits. And EY, there's a huge power of arbitrators. Arbitrators have a huge power. And then sort of reflecting on why my reaction personally to an appeal process in an international commercial arbitration just doesn't seem to fit for me. I found myself listening to Carrie and thinking, is it part of the morality of international commercial arbitration to have a review on the merits? And for me, it's not, but where I struggle is with the morality of international commercial arbitration being based on the autonomy of the parties. So if you prioritize the autonomy of the parties, it is their process. They can do whatever they want of that process, no matter what the eventual result will be, whether they foresaw it or not. And parties are asking for an appellate process or writing it in, then party says, well, why not? So I struggle a little bit because I feel a bit like this is some of the other topics that are on the agenda today, and the lunch night topic about how do you make California a more attractive seat. We struggle from a lot of these similar things up north. We are not as litigious as our American brothers, but that whole court process with discovery is the way that we do litigation. One book of rules for all claims. And you can see how it makes sense when you need one book of rules for everything that might come before a court of inherent jurisdiction. But in an international commercial arbitration, when you've gotten there through a breach of contract, where the parties were in a relationship with one another and know each other, the nature of the case is fundamentally different. And so this process has developed over the years to marry the different backgrounds of international parties who do not come from a shared legal background. So you've got some elements of civil law procedure, some elements of common law procedure, and it's not one or the other, but it attempts to walk the line between the two. And one of the things that seems to be part of that element of an international process is no appeal on the merits, which sort of makes sense if you think about the fact that they don't come from a shared legal background. So it's not like a court of inherent jurisdiction, everybody comes there and people need to figure out what the law is by reading the cases that are precedents for others coming before. Really, even though it is adjudicative, it is for those parties in that dispute without trying to make law for other people. So does it really matter whether the arbitrators got the law right? I don't know. I mean, it's applying legal tools to solve a business dispute, which may not necessarily be a legal dispute anyway, but you need to find an answer, and so you use the law as the best available tool to get there if you can't get there through mediation or negotiation or other ways. So that's always been my thinking process on appeals, is that it doesn't really fit. So I've struggled a bit as I've seen discussions about it in the local bar and having it pop up in rules. An institution whose office is across the street from me. They didn't ask me, by the way, about whether I thought this was a good idea, so that was the first mistake. But as far as I can tell, they didn't ask many people. And I think what happens is when you have this mixing of different processes, so domestic arbitration, that's an alternative to the court where you otherwise would get a judgment from a judge that would be subject to appeal. You expect a judge to get the law right. And then you move that into a domestic commercial arbitration where you have parties from that shared legal background fighting it out, but they decided they don't want the courts. There's still an assumption in there that the law that they understand is going to apply to their suit the way that it's supposed to apply. And many of our domestic arbitration statutes in Canada have reserved some measure of appeal rather than review of an award. For domestic cases. Our Supreme Court now has started to narrow those terms. So despite the fact that those appellate rights are there for certain areas, in particular in BC, we'll see it later, but you're looking for errors of law, pure errors of law. So what our Supreme Court has said is, we know that traditionally the interpretation of a contract is an error of law. So what was happening is courts, hostile to arbitration, wanting more of that commercial work for themselves if it's interesting, were saying, oh yeah, no, we'll give you, we'll let you appeal that case so that we can have a kick at this interesting legal issue. And you interpreted the contract and the contract is law and therefore you, you know, come on in. The Supreme Court said, no, wait a minute. That's a really old rule. That was when juries were the ones who determined, you know, certain issues, and they were divided that way because they were illiterate and they didn't know. So you can't just, you know, that rule doesn't make sense anymore in today's world. And so, no, that is not an error of law. You need to find an inextricable error of law that does not relate to the arbitrator's interpretation of that contract. So both, it's in reaction to that case law now that is further closing the door on domestic arbitration appeals, that you're starting to see, I think, this proliferation of rules. Because there are a few people, of course, who are concerned. You have a negative experience, and you don't want to do that. And so how do you do that? You try to find a way around it. And so people have started building up these rules.
So clearly the Supreme Court is under Mike's influence, because we are losing we are losing this right to appeal. When we look at and we should be fair to say that's in the domestic context. That's never been extended to the international arbitration context.
Because there is no appeal to a court from an international arbitration award. That is what the model law does.
So when reviewing some of these standards, to get back to the where we started off with Mike, look at some of these standards, the Spanish court of arbitration makes the assertion, at least in their prologue to their rules, they say that they've surveyed the business community, and this is something that has been done in reaction to the business community's desire for this. Now, I'm going to turn to Grant there at the end because two reasons. One is he's in the center or near the center of technology, which is the Silicon Valley area. He's actually in San Francisco, but he's an officer. But obviously
there's more and more technology in San Francisco, too.
Yeah, exactly. Technology doesn't stop in Silicon Valley. For that reason, and the second reason, I'm going to ask Grant, because he spent a lot of his time in his career navigating the cross-border disputes between particularly the Pacific Rim, Asia area, and the United States. Do you think, in surveying both the industry and potentially non-U.S. clients in Asia, do you think there's any appetite for this kind of approach, or is it uniformly a bad idea for them as well?
Well, so I think the jury's a little bit out on that, but it's kind of, without having done a scientific study, you do hear a lot of Silicon Valley tech companies say, I would never do arbitration. And there are various reasons. I think one Maria alluded to earlier, which is if you have a bad experience with court, you don't say, I'm never going to do litigation again. Here's the way it is. You have a bad experience with arbitration, well, you can actually, you can choose to do it or not. So. But the other reason for technology companies is to say, my IP is my crown jewels. This is so important. And I don't want to have that at the mercy of a process where I don't get to have an appeal in a second by the AI if something goes wrong. So you hear that a lot. I have actually not, seen a lot of evidence of appeals actually being used. But I think that is probably why JAMS and ICGR and others because they were hearing users say, we want to do it. And it does get used. It feels just unusual.
So let's make it scientific. Everyone in the room who thinks that appellate procedures, internal appeals arbitration procedures are a terrible idea, raise your hand. And those of you who are willing to go out on the ledge and try it, raise your hand. So we have there is some diversity of opinion on this issue. It looks like to some degree. Yes.
Well, we're in the new kid on the block, federal arbitration. And when we started federal arbitration, we adopted as the set of rules that you follow, subject to changing whatever you want to change, the federal rules. We have over 55 federal judges on our list of arbitrators. So we're a very narrow, focused organization. And it was very easy for us to adopt the federal rules of the federal appellate rules. So as an option, though, we found that parties did not want to appeal, even parties that wanted a federal-type litigation. And our practice is growing. We have never had a single case in which the parties have sought to appeal. So we, even though we provide the option. Now, I tell you this because Michael raised some interesting questions about the economics of it. A major company asked me to present, why would you ever want to appeal in an arbitral process? And there is a good empirical case to be made for it. If you have a single arbitrator and you look at the percentage of appeals taken from federal district judges and you calculate the cost of the savings that you have by having one arbitrator instead of three, and you look at the very small percentage of cases that are taken on appeal, and then the even much smaller percentage of cases where there actually is a reversal, it comes out very favorably to having an appellate process, an optional appellate process, if you select, just if you want to limit your activity to single arbitrator. So I just wanted to give you that, and I'll send you a copy of the FedArb rules where we have all this laid out.
I actually think that's an excellent point, and I let me add that the comments I made were on the assumption that you have a three-person appellate panel. I agree with you that if you just have one person, the odds go up of having an erroneous decision of some kind. I think if you have three people, you're generally going to have a better result, or accurate result.
I agree with that.
Gotcha.
Yes, I was going to just make a comment on the discussion on appeal and investor state arbitration, where there things are a little bit different. And we talked this morning about the criticism against the system. And one of the ways to deal with this criticism and to prove that the system is legitimate is to offer an appellate mechanism. The investor state disputes. And this was actually proposed by the US in its 2004 model DAT, but the US did not pursue it. There was a whole discussion in the international community on this, and now we saw it resurfacing in the agreement between Canada and the EU, where they do provide an appellate body. The same way as it is the first instance with state-appointed judges and so on. So, but there the idea is to appeal error of law and facts. And this way, when you deal with these disputes that have such a strong policy, public policy component, you basically make the system more legitimate for those who criticize it.
Yes.
Yeah, I echo what Katia said, that the investment arbitration, the appeal issue is much more highly debated. A lot of discussion, because we have seen the Argentina case, that the different tribunal makes entirely different decisions, and it's being approved by the users. Nevertheless, there's no way to remedy it. So it's inevitable that the appellate body may be in place, because public policy issues are very pertinent in the investment arbitration. As you see in the WTO, there's an appellate body. So the people who do the public law exercise, public law lawyers, who think that this is necessary to maintain the public policy issues. So what about this commercial arbitration? I agree that we might not need an appellate body, because it's another hurdle, as you had mentioned. But I would present this idea, because traditionally commercial arbitration is limited only to privately dispositive issues. But these days, we are dealing with the IP disputes and antitrust matters, and these issues which were on the borderline that traditionally commercial arbitrator didn't deal with. But there are a lot of nature that require a commercial arbitration has to deal with. So if we involve encroaching these public policy areas, probably we might introduce some appellate mechanism to give a market to an option that there is some correction mechanism, so that they are less concerned to try in the first level of arbitration. As Grant has mentioned, if they have an IP issue so critical, then they have a second chance. Probably they will come back to the international arbitration.
It's interesting, because you put your finger on two things. You put your finger on, one, the enormous effect of these decisions. One, that we're dealing with public policy. But secondly, you also kind of alluded to at the one point that you're having conflicting decisions. And as we've been reminded continually by our civil law practitioner friends, the Dixon Awards are not supposed to have precedential value necessarily. But we're kind of seeing that there is some need for alignment on outcomes, and I think you're putting your finger a little bit on that as well, saying that an appellate process may help us align some of these outcomes.
Yeah, but going back to the issue of whether it's a good idea or a bad idea, I think it's one thing that's clear, nobody's talking about making this mandatory. Mm-hmm. The real question is, if users want to have this option, should they have the option? actually, I think on that, Tina, maybe one of your slides might be relevant. The question is, actually in the U.S. historically, the way people tried to do this was to build this into the challenge as a ground for challenge of the board. Normally, of course, challenge of arbitral awards is very narrow. And so there was a famous case, which actually Maria worked on, or in my prior firm worked on, where the party said, well, no, in fact, the grounds for a challenge include the Federal Arbitration Act and you know, like errors of law, clear errors of fact, but the courts blocked that. Do you want to
That's a good transition to Tina's review. Yeah.
I think that.
So Tina will take us through some of the standards of review and what are the standards around some of these arbitration appeal processes.
So I will now truncate some of these slides because it's been preempted by some of this discussion, but sort of at a high level, I was going to get back to the main approach in particular in international arbitration, which is what we're talking about today, that arbitral awards are meant to be final and binding with no appeal. The difference, quickly, and I can do it very quickly, the difference between a challenge and an appeal, and then what possible standards of review are if you do create an appeal to another appeal tribunal, so this is the private. So in preparing, I came across this quote from Redfern and Hunter, which I have seen before. It's a little bit long, but it did sort of speak to me in terms of putting in my mind that I'm maybe not the only one who sees it incompatible. That it says most institutional rules provide unequivocally that an arbitral award is final and binding. These are not intended to be empty words. One of the advantages of arbitration is that it is intended to result in the final determination of the dispute between the parties. If the parties want a compromise solution to be proposed, they should offer mediation. If they are prepared to fight the case to the highest court in the land, they should offer litigation. By choosing arbitration, the parties choose, in principle, finality. An arbitral award is not intended to be a mere proposal as to how the dispute might be resolved, nor is it intended to be the first step on a ladder of appeals through national courts. So, you know, a little self-serving to those of us in the international arbitration community, but I think the fact is that train has left the station. You have read the model law and you are in a model law jurisdiction. There is no appeal to a court from your award, period. You do still, of course, have the ability to apply set aside an award or resist enforcement if you don't actually apply the seat. These are very limited circumstances. They mainly relate to breaches of due process, excess of jurisdiction, and procedural treatment of the parties that was unfair. And then, of course, I heard referred to this morning as a wild card public policy as to how that plays out in terms of what your award looks like. But very, very rare. You know, I also heard unusual to be successful on a set-aside application of the international arbitration award in U.S. courts. The same is true in Canada. The same is true in most places. I'm very sorry about that.
We ultimately prevailed there, so I feel bad again.
One of the jurisdictions that is known to be an exception to this is England, which despite being a very popular place to seek your international arbitrations, it does preserve a right of appeal from arbitral awards, and they do not make a distinction between international and domestic. So there is a possible right of appeal, but only on questions of English law. So the English courts, if you've got a London seated arbitration under New York law, you're not going to be able to take your appeal to the English courts on error of New York law. You need the leave of the court, and the standard there is that the decision of the tribunal on the question of law is obviously wrong. The question is one of general public importance, or that it is at least open to serious doubt such that it would be just and proper in all the circumstances for the court to determine the question. So very limited. But what the courts have done as well in interpreting this is they've said it's very easy to waive this right of appeal. So if you are in a London-seated ICC arbitration, and those rules provide that the award is final and binding. That is enough to waive your right of appeal in money from that award. So when you're looking at domestic arbitral awards, as I mentioned in British Columbia, we still have a limited right of appeal from that domestic award that is being narrowed by our courts, but they exist. But they vary by jurisdiction. So some places may let you appeal an award based on a mistake of law, others a mistake of fact, sometimes a mixed question of law and fact, sometimes only if it's also of public importance or really relevant to the parties. But the point here just being there is no universal standard of review of arbitral awards, even in courts. Different courts look at it differently. We saw what the English law one was, and it's slightly different. I've used BC's here as an illustration of how it's slightly different. So this is what our limited provision is now. It's a question of law arising out of the award. If the parties consent, so you know, if the parties say, yeah, we both agree that the arbitrator got that wrong, the courts will look at it. For some reason, that never happens. Or the court grants leave to appeal. So you usually see this in an application for leave. What does the court look at when it's deciding whether or not to grant leave? So it's not an appeal as of right. Somebody looks at it to figure out whether or not it's important enough for you to get your appeal. And then it's what I just mentioned, importance of the results to parties, and also miscarriage of justice, or importance to some class or body of persons of which the applicant is a member. This is an area where it sort of makes sense. When you're looking at like a standard form contract, and the arbitrator has made a decision on the interpretation of something like a FIDIC contract, for example, and gotten it wrong, and that matters to the parties, but not just the parties beyond. For standard form insurance agreement, those things have meaning beyond just the parties, and that's where you can see this really makes sense. And the other option is the right laws of general or public importance, which it's kind of hard to imagine what that would be in a private arbitration, but it's there. And then what can the court do? If it does allow the appeal, it can confirm, it can amend, or it can set aside the award. Or it can remit the award to the arbitrator together with the court's opinion on the question of law that was set for the appeal. So this poses a little interesting question. This all works well when you have parties in the same jurisdiction, subject to the jurisdiction of the court. And the court then can send something back to the arbitrator. But in an international context, when you have created the jurisdiction of that arbitrator through party consent and autonomy, and an arbitrator renders an award and then becomes functus officio, can a tribunal that is also not a court of inherent jurisdiction with any state authority send a matter back to a tribunal that is functus and no longer has jurisdiction for the purpose of correcting its award? Maybe, but one that I haven't seen institutions who have those rules in do it. So this is just a look at you know, what can the parties do? Grant mentioned Kyocera, Hall Street Associates is another one. One thing that the parties cannot do is say, we're just going to agree that if we're not happy with the result, that we can appeal it to the courts. Like, well, we're going to take our arbitration award, and then we're just going to let a judge look at it and appeal it. The parties said, no, you can't tell us what to do. That's not how we decide our dockets. Too bad, which of course makes sense, but has tied the parties' hands a little bit in terms of what they can do. So they cannot expand their appellate rights that are available under those statutes. So for example, the BC standard, you couldn't add another ground of appeal in the arbitration award and then have a court through that appeal. But you can create your own appellate tribunal. So this is a quick look, a very high level look at some of the organizations who have done this. Here's JAMS optional arbitration appeal procedure. I know these are all optional, notwithstanding the abysmal original drafting of the ECICA submit rules on this. I am told that they are also meant to be optional. You cannot just decide to bring an application for leave to appeal without having opted in to the appellate portion of the rules, and you cannot do that in DC until after the dispute arises. So you don't write in the appellate rules into your contract after the dispute arises, then you decide to opt into them. I think these will function differently. You could do it right from the outset. So that
is that after the dispute arises, but before the arbitration starts?
Presumably you could opt in later. But at that point, who's going to agree? it's the thing about arbitration. It's easy to get consent when there's no dispute. As soon as there's a dispute, it's in somebody's favor to not consent or to do something different or to be difficult or whatever it is in most cases. So the Jans rules already mentioned, they're applying the same standard review that a first-level appellate court in a jurisdiction would apply when appeal from the trial court decision. So that could be different depending on what jurisdiction you're in.
Well, I just want to ask you on that briefly, as we're talking about this in the context of international arbitration, does it strike you that this, you know, the entire idea behind international arbitration, at least in theory, is that we try to delocalize everything, we try to keep it as an independent system that's not dependent upon the local jurisdiction to take its standards and so forth. Is this, do you think this is can fit in the international arbitration context?
I think it could fit. It's just a little bit awkward. Because it's not totally clear to me. You're looking at, this is the same as an appeal from a trial court decision. So that whole process is going to be necessarily foreign to one of the parties, at least one of the parties. If you have a situation where the parties have chosen a neutral forum, so say you've got your, I've seen this happen so that everybody can be happy about this, European and Asian parties chose San Francisco as their seat of arbitration, so they had nothing to do with the jurisdiction and they seated their arbitration here. No hearings happened here, sorry. But it did happen. Why would what the California courts do on an appeal of a trial decision have anything to do with anything that the parties expected when they entered into that agreement? It just seems odd. And then this is what, you know, JAM says that their panel can do when they have an appeal. They can affirm the original award, reverse it, or modify an award. This makes a lot of sense when, you know, most of your arbitrators are former judges, right, too. This is language that they're used to. These are standards that they're used to. It's within a culture that they're used to. But, you know, I would argue that that's one of the things you have to be very careful about if you're going to be promoting California as a seat of international arbitration, is to not let that very highly developed, workable but parochial system infiltrate an international arbitration procedure. They need to be kept distinct. So you need to keep out consumer arbitration, you need to keep out employment arbitration, you also need to keep out domestic arbitration in my submission. Because they're different animals. It's one thing when everyone has a shared legal system and shared legal background and the same expectations. As soon as they have different expectations, it is a whole different ballgame. And if you want to be players in that really international arbitration world, you have to be able to leave aside those practices and say, yeah, that's how we do things in California. They work really well here, but we know how you do it in international arbitration. And we're not going to come to this process with all of that domestic baggage and make you, you know, subject the international process to Americanization or litigationization or whatever the words are that we have seen. We recognize that it's a different system, and we're sophisticated, and we know how to do that too. And we know the law.
I'm going to be a little controversial here and say that, you know, initially years ago, early in my career, this whole notion of appeal, I would have opposed it. And that was sort of the traditionalist in me. as I've been in California for almost over 20 years now, I've become more Californian, and I think I've evolved. I am moving in the direction of what I said earlier, what Carrie said earlier, which is let the parties, with guidance from the council, determine what was the saying, was the forum that fits the fuss, you said. Yes. They are best equipped to determine that. And if it's an option, put it on the menu, let them vet it, and if they choose it, they choose it. It doesn't have to be, JAMS designated the trial court standard here. It doesn't have to be that. It could be like the English standard. I don't think we should box ourselves into the old international arbitration approach necessarily on everything. And if we're going to face all the criticism that comes our way, we need to be open to changes, right? So I also wanted to say one other thing, which is the Kyocera case that we talked about. This was a really tough call for the Ninth Circuit. It actually ruled that you could create that jurisdiction first for review by a court. And yes, at first decided you could, and it enforced that clause, and we actually went back to the federal court, we had review. Then the Ninth Circuit sua sponte revisited the question on its own and said, no, you can't do it. But then Hull Street came many years later, and guess what happened 6 months after Hull Street? The California State Supreme Court said, that's all well and good for the federal courts, but we here in California, we believe in autonomy, and if you, the parties, are very explicit in saying that's what you want judicial review of your for errors of law and fact of your arbitration decision, you can have it. But you need to be absolutely unambiguous about it, and then we'll enforce it. So there is that little wrinkle here in California. I don't think it's necessarily a bad thing if you have sophisticated parties who know what they're doing and they ask for it, and it gives comfort to all the tech companies who say, I am terrified of handing this huge decision that will make or break my company to one arbitrator or even one panel of arbitrators.
So, yeah, yes.
I defer to Carrie.
Okay.
Well, I have a very serious question about all this. So in the early days of CPR, I don't know what Abe's going to say about this, in the early days of CPR, I was approached by a few federal judges who were sitting and who said, how about if we set ourselves up as an optional appeals panel with or without CPR, you know, blessing, to be an appeals panel from any privately agreed to arbitration that happened. I'm sorry, I'm a law professor, and I say, and you guys are federal judges, do you want to tell me where in the U.S. Code is a jurisdictional grant of power to an appellate court? These are federal judges. Not to mention that shortly after that, I don't know if anybody else knows about this, a group of judges in Connecticut that were both federal and state founded an organization called STAFED, different from FedAR, but they actually founded an organization called STAFED, which was a combination of state and federal judges in the state of Connecticut that were going to moonlight at night, or whatever, on the weekends, on their way from the bench and be an optional appeals panel. That was a little more interesting to me because, again, if people go to them, I suppose they can have a private business. That would have to do with what both the federal and state judicial ethics rules were about what you can do when you're not on the bench. But I am interested in the question of, as a former practicing trial lawyer and someone who still teaches procedure sometimes, what is the jurisdictional grant to a court of appeals in the federal system if parties say, we want to appeal, and there's been no federal trial proceeding before that. What's the section that you're counting on when you file your brief in the Ninth Circuit that says we'd like to appeal for our private arbitration award?
What happened to state then?
They went out of business very quickly.
People got fed up with state then.
They realized the conflict of interest problem, and some of the judges were a little worried that. But I'm actually still interested in what the grant of federal jurisdiction is to a federal appeals court when there's no trial court below to appeal from.
That's let's get back. Let's go.
A little technical
no, that's an interesting one, and then we'll get back to that. Just quickly on.
You know, the problem that most parties face where they've hired a sophisticated panel and even a sophisticated single arbitrator is not the lack of a right to appeal, it's the lack of a right to move for reconsideration, to point out to the decider that you made a mistake. And of course, apropos of Tina quoting me on saying, you want to get it right, it, what's horrifying to any arbitrator is to make a mistake and to have no recourse. And I, you know, we all have our stories. I presided as a single arbitrator over cases that were so big I'll probably never see them again, between two global financial institutions. Multi-weeks of hearing, and it was, I'm thinking, how am I going to get this right? They had a clause which said, any final award, I forget the exact language, a party can move for reconsideration of the final award. It could not have been simpler. Now you would think, oh, well, they're going to reconsider everything. But so what? They would do that in a trial court before they went to appeal. So needless to say, I rendered a 140-page, trust me, findings of fact. And of course, somewhere in there, there was a mistake. And you know what the mistake was? It amounted to about $25,000, but it was the principle of the thing. I corrected it. And they didn't seek on both sides to correct that much. But the party who was the other side didn't oppose the correction, actually. It wasn't clear. I corrected it, and I saw in the public filing that the award was paid 3 weeks later. So they would have torn their hair out over that thing. I would have torn my hair out if I knew about it. They could not have gotten it vacated. Under the rules of the AAA, they could, it wouldn't have been a correction. So sometimes look at the problem. The problem is not always as big as we think it is. And sophisticated parties can draft against it even after they started the arbitration.
Well, it's interesting. Computational errors are usually something that you can fix through the ICC court system, or at least challenge the ICC court system.
But I'm saying it's not, it was not computational.
Oh, exactly.
It resulted in about a $25,000 change, but it was the way I got to it. It bothered them. Now, why? Who knows why? But the point was, once that got fixed, they were good to go, and the award. It's very, very. The claims going back and forth, but they paid it. Everybody was fine.
We really need to move on to grants.
Well, I think that was a plan because that's exactly, you know, one of the issues I talked about. I'm going to skip through most of these. I'm talking about things that kind of try to get the benefits of appeal without the drawbacks. Obviously, there's nothing, if you really want to appeal, you have to do an appeal. But when you're talking about why do people want to appeal in the first, that's exactly one of the problems. Just suppose there's a mistake and you want to correct it, there's no motion for reconsideration. What you mentioned is a great idea. I'm not sure if that actually works, though. Because is that, when is the award final? Or you'd have to draft carefully. Because if the award is called an award, you're not supposed to be able to do that. So. Anyway, as Nathan mentioned, ICC rules, ICDR, JAMS rules, they all allow narrow requests to correct an award, which are usually computational errors, which can be substantive, it can be millions of dollars, but just a math error, and unfortunately a lot of arbitrators are not very good at that, and you know, you can fix that. But actually the provision I had not focused on before is that most of these rules also allow interpretation. Now, what exactly does that mean? I don't think it's supposed to be carte blanche for, hey, you know, just redo the award. But if something's unclear, and I actually used this recently, and it was unclear when you read the final award, is it compound interest or simple interest? The parties had fought about it. It was several million dollars. Couldn't tell. We could go back to the tribunal within 30 days and just said, and they said, well, of course it's simple, which is what we thought. But if you didn't have that in the rule, you couldn't do it. I mean, it would just be a problem. But the exact issue I mentioned, you mentioned, I know some arbitrators are doing this. I know one particular is a JAMS judge, federal judge, patent license dispute. And instead of issuing a final award, he issued what he called a draft award. And he some people call it a tentative ruling or something. And he did it kind of sua sponte. He just said, you know, I think this is a complicated case. I want you to take a look at this. So it's not actually a final award. And at that time, the firm I was at was on the losing end, and they said, well, this actually involves the issue of Japanese patent law, where you're just wrong. And it was a federal judge, he's not a Japanese judge. And there was a motion basically for reconsideration, and the judge looked at it and said, that's interesting. Let's have another hearing on Japanese law with the experts, and change the result. So this is actually something potentially that can be done. It's not a separate review by somebody else, but I think this is a very clever thing, and I certainly wouldn't recommend it for every case, but I can imagine cases where parties might want to do it or the judge might want to suggest it. Again, I don't think it's every case. And if the parties wanted to build that in, maybe they could. Let's see, what else I got? This one's kind of obscure. I don't know if I really
The Swiss-German...
The Swiss-German
thing. Well, I mean, you and I both have had it, but maybe...
Yeah, but this actually relates more to what was happening this morning on that mediation and hybrid things. And, you know, so for a long time, I thought this was like an East Asian issue. The idea that you're in arbitration and some of the arbitrators say, you know what, why don't we settle? I think you should settle for this much. That's common in China, domestic, CTAC and Korean courts and some other courts. But actually in Germany, it's common. And in German-influenced Swiss courts, it's also common. And they have this fancy Latin word, which I won't try to pronounce. But basically, the judge sits... It's kind of like an early neutral evaluation, E&E in California, but it's the judge, the merits judge, at a fairly early phase, sits down with the parties and says, you know what? This is what I'm thinking. It's a preliminary opinion. I might change my mind. Now, this is very different from what we were just talking about, but highly controversial. Because in some cultures, this is perfectly normal. It actually kind of makes sense that the judge who's deciding the case, he should be the one who tries to settle it. But other people say, oh, that's blasphemy. You can't do it. Well, actually, just different countries do it in different ways. We had a Swiss arbitration where our Swiss arbitrator said, you know, we've got this procedure. You don't have to do it. We understand. But we wondered what you might be interested in. It was a complicated biotech patent license case involving issues of contract interpretation, patent infringement and validity, contract interpretation under Swiss law, patent, or under U.S. law. And just trying to, and when I first read the patent, I had no clue what it was about. I mean, the technology learning curve was huge. So we thought about it, and our client, which was the U.S. side, not the Swiss side, said, well, you know, we're kind of interested because we'd like to know what the judges, what the arbitrators are thinking of. Because as an advocate, you know, you don't want to waste your time. You don't want to spend a lot of time arguing the wrong issue. And, you know, arbitrations are complicated. You only have so much time. So you may end up only spending 5 minutes on the dispositive issue. So we thought it would be helpful. So we did do it. And then in the actual Swiss-German procedure, what can happen is that goes into settlement. In this ICC arbitration, the arbitrators were very careful. They said, first, sign a bunch of stuff. You're never going to, you know, sue us for doing this weird thing. Second, it's totally off the record, can never be quoted. And third, they gave us their opinion orally. And then they said, you guys can go top settlement if you want, but we're not going to have anything to do with it at all.
Yeah.
And at the end, just tell us whether you settle or not.
But just to interject, I had a very similar experience. It wasn't the German influence force, was one, but in Geneva, where they did exactly the same thing. And I found it quite effective.
Yeah. But anyway, that's a little bit off topic. When we were talking about this stuff, this came up as another thing. The way it links back to the question of appeals is how much information, how much feedback is the arbitrator giving to the parties about what the arbitrator is thinking about? Because an advocate, you know, the worst thing is you lose on an issue that either was never argued, which is not rare, but maybe it wasn't really at the forefront. And you wish you had another chance to argue that. And, you know, arbitrators in some cultures, it's kind of considered improper to even say what you're thinking because it's like somehow biased or something. As an advocate, I always want, of course, I always want to win, but I also would like to know what the arbitrator is thinking. I want to know what the issues are that the arbitrator is concerned with. Did your case settle, or did you?
Well, we did, but it links back to the appeal process, like you say, because I think that it at least gives everyone a chance to know where it's going, and then a chance to re-argue or at least clarify what's going on, which is the ultimate intent.
Right. We didn't settle then, but we certainly knew. I mean, it was good news and bad news. We were winning on some issues and losing on some issues, so we said, "Gee, we better focus here." So it was helpful. It didn't have to be done that way. You know, the last thing here, I've got the internal review by the institution. This is independent review. Of course, the ICC is the famous case. Everybody, all institutions review the award, but the ICC is more higher level of scrutiny. You know, one of the therapeutic effects of this, though, is just as an arbitrator, if you know somebody's really going to take a look at your award, you may be a little bit, and of course, everybody's careful. But still, as a practical matter, if you know somebody's looking over your shoulder, you may look at it a little bit more carefully. I guess I've got maybe 30 seconds more. One other thing, though. Why do you want to have people of appeals, and especially the IP case? Well, the stakes are so high. So like in an IP case,
If you're on the defendant's side and you lose, you make it out of business. You know, you're just an injunction. You're shut down. You can't. You're just done. You're dead. On the patent holder side, not quite as bad, but it can be, because the worst case is your patent is killed. It's held to be invalid, right? And you can't not only not sue this person, but you can't sue anybody on it. Really bad. Well, that is possible for the parties to agree around it, probably not at the, well, actually, I've heard it happen. I know there's a big biotech case that does this quite often with license disputes with their licensee. And really the question is how much money is going to be paid. And they go into bounded arbitration. Basically, it's the amount of the license, and it's going to be, between a low of this amount and a high of this amount, and anywhere in between. But that means the licensor knows they're not going out of business because they get a license. And the licensee. And the licensor knows their patent's not going to get killed.
Right.
And that, I think, if you look at why is patent litigation so expensive, because that's one of them. Because if the stakes are kind of life or death for both sides, you've got to spend a lot of money,
Okay, question over there.
I just want to take away from the last point you made about it being so popular in IP disputes. And it's really interesting to me because in India, in 2016, it was a time when they officially nodded on saying, okay, appellate review is fine and it's valid. And what was interesting is that the Supreme Court went through all these cases from the lower courts, and the one thing that came up again and again was that it was mostly commodities and trade-related arbitrations. And which is also kind of true even in literature, you kind of always come across this being more popular with commodities arbitration and trade-related arbitrations. Which is what makes me wonder is, because we are discussing an important process, but maybe there's a discussion that's required about who are the users. And I feel like, maybe IP people find this to be important because there's a lot at stake. But I was wondering, why do commodities and trade, why do they find it to be such an important mechanism that they always want to opt
in? Well, in this sense, you also find type processes built into other model contracts for other industries. FIDIC as an example, it's not quite an appellate process, but there you have an adjudicated process that takes place with an adjudication body, and then it's reviewed by the ICC arbitral tribunal that's appointed later. So these kinds of ideas are being built in. I just want to get to a few more. There's a few more hands over there. I wanted to just get to before we finish up.
Practitioner, and I have commercial disputes and arbitration procedures as well. So I just wanted to add maybe some small input on the reference and audience. So I completely agree with everything that you just said. Just to give you like a better idea about how this comes from. So it's actually this standard proceedings they do in commercial courts. And it's literally about forcing people into settlement. What they do is they do, as you said, only orally, but they give you like the intended opinion. And you have to understand the structure of the commercial court because you always have, there are two representatives. So you have three judges, like one or three judges, and then you have two representatives from that specific, field. Like I have like a complex insurance dispute, and there was the one representative for the insurances and one representative for the counterparty. So the dynamics are like very different. There is also some politics there, and just the commercial court tries to avoid to have a decision that's going to be appealed.
Right. Yeah. So that's it. I said my ICC arbitration. I heard exactly the same thing from our local council. Some people, the bad reputation. A lot of it's not so much culture. It's just the judge is kind of lazy, and just says, "Look, you better settle, or you're going to regret it." And people don't feel that's a very comfortable process. In our situation, our arbitrators were very different. They just said, "This is what we're thinking now. We may change our mind." If you want to settle, fine. If you don't, it's fine. So I think there's a big difference.
But so, and when you try to transform these proceedings into arbitration, you have a whole different setup because of the fee for the arbitrators. They are not necessarily interested in settling the case, to be honest, depending on the mechanics how you get through. So, to be honest. So that's one part. And the other part
I
is...
I don't know if we can handle that much honesty. Yeah.
Yeah, but, you know, ICC arbitration, you're not paid on your time. So
this is true.
Or not solely on time.
But we need to, we have an appellate review process here where Rich Cherney could review by building up this process on track. So we are very close to the very end of this. Thank you again to our panel for giving us a lot of information.